Welcome, everyone, to the Workforce Navigator podcast. I'm Steve McDonald, your host. Today, we have not only very interesting, but a very global perspective to bring onto the podcast. We're going to be talking with Anand Sood, and Anand, you're the VP and CHRO of Peckham Industries. But what's really interesting about your background, different than anybody we've ever had on the podcast, is that you've actually worked and lived in 8 different countries. You worked in small organizations up to global multinationals. You also have worked in multiple different industries, from life sciences to manufacturing. And I'll let you expand a little bit more about this. But what we're going to be talking about throughout all of that experience is the 3 hallmarks that are, I would say, not forgotten, but not top of mind with chief people officers, CROs today. And the way that you talked about it when we talked before, it rises up to one of the most important things to do if you're creating high-performance teams and leading high-performance teams. Because one thing that we do know is that almost every company is global these days, whether it's employees that are in different parts of the world, partners, clients, supply chain, you name it. We are a global society. And so this has a tremendous impact on how we create then the teams and the success for our companies. But before we jump right in, what I'd love to do is just have you explain a little bit more about your background, and then we'll get started.
Thanks, Steve. Happy to be on the podcast. So you're right. I've lived in several countries. I was born in Asia, so by birth I'm Malaysian, but I went to school in Australia, UK, and then worked in Thailand, China, Korea. Been with companies like Black & Decker in household manufacturing. Prior to that, I was with the Shangri-La, which is a hospitality chain. And then with Dow Corning, which is now part of Dow Chemical. I was with them for 15 years, worked across multiple locations in so many different types of roles as a business partner, as a talent manager, and then I worked with them in the corporate office in Midland. And then also worked with a life sciences company called Thermo Fisher Scientific. Again, multiple locations in the U.S. and very global company. And in the last 3 years, I've been the Vice President and Chief Human Resources Officer here at Peckham Industries, which is a construction materials provider, primarily in the Northeast of the U.S.
Fantastic. I want to tap in right away to all this global experience across 8 different countries, 8 different cultures, because you've got a very specific point of view on creating these high-performance teams and leading these teams, and it all has to do with adaptability. And so I'd love to have you just start out and explain adaptability, why you think it's so important, and what your definition of it is.
Absolutely. I think one of the key leadership skills, and it's probably underrated or underspoken about, is adaptability. We all live and work in a world where there are so many different cultures. It's all about the people. People are different, and different cultures bring about different communication preferences, different work preferences. The communication preference is obviously rooted in language. Not everybody speaks the same language. They speak English, but different backgrounds. From a cultural standpoint, although they may be working in the same company or in the same country, and the goals may be the same, but the paths that lead to attaining those goals could be different. So how do you adapt? What I've learned, having had the benefit of working for some of these great companies, great managers in different locations and different businesses, is how to appreciate diversity and navigate through those differences and deliver results. And I was thinking about a couple of examples on how I could highlight this. And one was a mistake that I made earlier in my career at Dow. I was based in Malaysia, and we were hiring for a country HR manager in Korea. Because I was remote and I trusted the country managing director of Korea and the plan manager to interview the candidate and make the decision. I was part of the panel, but I was remote. And I didn't actually get to meet the candidate in person. But when I checked in with my Korean counterpart, said, "Oh, found you're a great person, and now you're really going to this guy." I said, "Great, come with me to meet this person." Unfortunately, if you know about the Korean management style, it's generally hierarchical. And there's a very strong respect for superior. They didn't fully appreciate or fully recognize this cultural factor. And because I was not present on the get-go, from the interview process and the onboarding process, and maybe delegated or could be perceived as abdicating the responsibility to hire this person. Later on, it became a challenge because as a regional HR leader and what happens in the country, there's sometimes conflict. And if your person on the ground, the country HR manager is not clear, who do I support here? Who do I work with? Who do I take my problems to? Then you could put not only yourself in a difficult situation, you could put your team in an awkward situation. Yeah. So that was a challenge. And so I learned from that, understanding, appreciating, and respecting the culture and the management ethic of the team that you're working with is going to be critically important, especially in a global context. So similar challenge came about when I had to hire the country HR manager for India. And this time I was in Thailand. So I learned from the Korean example. What I did this time was I made sure I got on a plane, went to Mumbai, worked with the interview team to hire the HR candidates. And then I flew the candidate from Mumbai to Bangkok, where I was located, for the final kind of the pre-hire conversation. And then got really involved in the 30-60-90 onboarding process so that there's absolute clarity who this person works for. So there's a couple of examples that I want to share. One was not so great, but the other one was how to learn from that and how do you navigate and still work with the country teams, your team, and the organization that you represent in a much more cohesive way. So that's an example of trying to be adaptable. I think another one is we talk about leadership development. And if you look at any of the Gartner study, any of the Hackett studies or McKinsey, every other month, leadership as a topic comes up as something that every company and every place in the world needs to get better at. And I was responsible for leadership development for all of the Asian area when I was in Asia for Dow Corning. And one of the countries we needed to get up to speed was Japan. One was, I quickly realized, just from an adaptability standpoint, was the decision-making among the Japanese is really consensus-based. So you got to get comfortable. Let me check and I'll get back to you. You got to be comfortable hearing that phrase over and over again, because you don't expect to go into a boardroom, put in the PowerPoint deck, and then the decision is going to be made on a date. It doesn't work like that. And also, specifically to this whole leadership development, one of the things that we're really trying to develop our leaders is to get better at our situational leadership. Now, this is an American concept. And there are four modes of that situational leadership, whereby you're going to be more directive, you're going to tell someone what to do. And then obviously, the fourth quadrant is where you empower them, they go do it and keep you in the loop. But guess what? Japan only operates in one mode. I tell you, do. So you've got to recognize that although this is very well intended, how is it going to come across locally within that cultural context? So how do we adapt and how do we extract the value of the leadership capability within the socio-economic context? I think that's very important, especially when we are really working in a global world today.
It's interesting because diversity has been a large part of the business press and acceptability and diversity. But we haven't typically thought about it in terms of how does that affect interpersonal relationships and skills? And then what I'm taking away from what you're saying is that the more culturally aware of diversity and adaptability that a leader is, the more effective that they're going to be as a leader.
Absolutely. You have to have a better understanding and appreciation of cultures. And one of the things that we did at Dow Corning and also at Thermo Fisher was we use a tool called the Cultural Orientation Indicator, COI. They may call it something else today, but essentially the tool tells you by default, how do you go about dealing with conflict? How do you work in a team? How do you solve problems? How do you make decisions? How do you look at time as a factor? And in different countries and different cultures that impact or influence, are you going to take conflict head on? Are you going to confront it? Or are you going to avert it? Is decision-making in a hierarchical situation based on the leader or in a much more consensus way? So there's so many aspects to this. And if you are Korean or a Japanese or a Thai, for example, and you are now on a business trip or you're beginning to engage with a global team, or maybe you're going to the head office, it could be in Europe or it could be the US, your counterparts and your colleagues have a very different cultural perspective. it's valuable for both parties to understand what the cultural differences are, just to be aware, because awareness is what's going to help you to be more effective in those conversations and in those meetings. So we did that. I did that knowing some of the challenges my colleagues had, especially in Asia, and also some of the challenges my Western colleagues had coming from the US or in Belgium or in France when they had to travel to Asia. And it was an immense help, especially in one-on-one coaching and the supervisor-employee relationships. It could be either way, Asian supervisor and somebody in the West who is a subordinate, or it could be a Western supervisor, or it could even be a coaching relationship. Just understanding the cultural differences and advances can go a long way to enhance communication. Because if you're not absolutely clear in the communication, then you're not going to be able to make the right decision. You're not going to be able to exercise proper judgment. And that's going to lead to poor engagement. And we all know what poor engagement leads to: attrition. Then rather than working with somebody, you're trying to fill a role. So you're not being productive. I think it's really important for people to understand the cultural differences on both sides.
And what you just started to get at here was how important this is, because there's so many factors to leadership and teams and working together. I just want, from your broad experience here in developing these teams and leading these teams, how important is this appreciation and adaptability for culture? If you said on a scale of 1 to 10 to create high performance leaders and teams, 1, it's not important at all. 10, it's vital to creating leaders in those teams. Where is it on that scale for you?
So I would clearly say it's north of 10. I'd probably give it 11 or 12. What's interesting is that a lot of companies have come to realize that. They probably don't call it out that explicitly, but that realization is definitely there. I've been in the business of crafting leadership programs for the different companies and divisions. And the first module of the first line manager or any management development program starts with knowing yourself. This is about an MBTI or a DISC or a StrengthsFinder. It's one of those tools or assessments. And essentially, what the companies are trying to do is to advise these managers that you got to know who you are, what is your communication preference, and more importantly, others may not share the same communication preference as you. So how are you going to be effective in the work environment? And you can also take this outside of a work environment. But essentially, a lot of these companies have come to the realization that this is very important. And as I benchmark some of the programs that we have put together, or I have put together with some of the other companies, there's a common element that the first program is really about knowing yourself. And typically involves some kind of assessment tool. And even if they don't do an assessment tool, they do a 360. Which is, again, how to get feedback. And one of the things that comes out of 360 is communication styles, communication preference, which also involves listening. So I would say that this is definitely something very important. The good news is a lot of companies realize it. It's in the program. We just need to do a better job communicating its importance.
And we just can't overlook these. I don't think a lot of us are aware that as we become more and more global, we need to become more and more aware. We need to become more and more adaptable. And that's one of a number of different areas where your recommendation for us is we need to be more adaptable. And I know that the Gen Z, you have some pretty concrete perceptions in terms of how do we need to be more adaptable now across generations inside of our companies.
Absolutely. So Gen Z or the post-millennial generation grew up in a very different technological environment than their supervisors or their managers in most situations. Much more digitally or technologically savvy, and their leadership style or their drive is really centered around a purpose. What are their objectives? What are they trying to achieve? That's their drive. This translates in the hiring process, the onboarding process, the career planning and leadership development process. So what we found is that with Gen Z, it's really critical to have a clear onboarding structure. You're 30, 60, 90, or even you're 180. Clarity of goals. A lot of them come out of colleges that may or may not have work experience because of the COVID-19 pandemic situation. And so if they come to a work environment and the trend now is 9 to 5, 5 days a week in person, so what are they actually going to do? So you need to have clarity so that they see the purpose of your role. So having structure, having clear outlines, having deliverables, having that engagement is very important. So one of the things that my team looks at is span of control. So you want to make sure that the supervisor and employee ratio is at a manageable number. Or is it 5 people, depending on the nature of the operations, if you're in a finance organization? Or is it 15 people, if it's a shop floor environment? Are the people in one location? Are they spread out? What's the use of technology? You want to understand span of control, because if the expectation is your manager needs to spend 15 minutes on a check-in conversation, how you're doing, what's going on, what are the issues that you're dealing with, beyond the blocking and tackling conversations, you need to create time, you need to create bandwidth in the supervision for that to actually happen. But we want to make sure that the supervisors are equipped to do this. We have to train the supervisors and managers on the importance of those conversations and how to have those conversations. I think the other element is that typically career planning conversations take place after you've been in the role for 5 years. You came in, you joined a company, you worked for a few years, you moved to another department, or you got a promotion, you've been enrolled, you've been in the company for 5 years. What does Joe, what does Sally want to do? Has anybody had a career conversation with them? I mean, Gen Z, you need to have conversation every year. So every 12 months, as part of the year-end review process, you need to have a career conversation. Because you've got to keep in mind, they're driven by a purpose. So they've got a clear goal, where they want to be, what their compensation should look like. Now, if a company, and every company is trying to grow, with growth comes opportunities. So how are you channeling those opportunities and leveraging them with your Gen Z population? So that requires a very hands-on leadership engagement with that population.
And why is it, do you think, that because career progression, understanding of responsibilities, lines of authority, all that kind of stuff, all generations have wanted that. What is it about Gen Z that is specifically different that you need to cater to them differently, do you think?
I think it's the mobility. Gen Z's grew up in the internet world. The internet has got no geographical boundary. Communication these days doesn't have a boundary. And I think if you grew up in that environment, you're going to be less limited by boundaries, restrictions. So how do you manage talent in a boundaryless environment? So if my purpose is not being met, how do I seek an opportunity where there's a better chance of me fulfilling my objectives or meeting my purpose in life? So keep in mind, if they have a purpose-driven leadership or purpose-driven style, how do we adapt to take advantage of that with our own company's opportunities and needs? The opportunities are always going to be there. It's how do we communicate them, how do we market them, and how do we leverage that talent? And so managers need to be equipped. It may not be something natural to them, and this is the role of HR and training and executive management, is to put together that culture and share those practices to better engage this segment of your talent. That is going to be the future.
Absolutely. It's interesting. So we've talked about adaptability and culture. We've talked about the impact of Gen Z and what they're looking for. But you also found something that was very interesting. Like, as Gen Zs are looking for that upward mobility and the ability to climb and make more money and take on more responsibility, not everyone that we hallmark as a leader really wants leadership, wants that role. And you have some really interesting perspectives and stories on that. We also have to take into account, as we're creating these high-performance teams and creating these leaders, sometimes from internal, sometimes from external.
Absolutely. So a successful leader is one that desires to be one. That's the premise. So understanding the desire for leadership is very key. So it's a balance between the will to be a leader and the skill to be a leader. And I think the will part to be a leader was very clear, especially when we are looking at leadership development, both at Dow, Corning, and in terms of Fisher. One region which was key was the Nordics. So Sweden, Finland, Denmark, some of those locations where they were Thermo Fisher's operations. And What I understood and what I observed as an HR leader was that there was very little, very small difference in terms of the salary increments from job level to job level. It boiled down to, what do you really want to do? So if I want to be a technologist, I want to be an engineer, you can do that and have a very successful career. You don't have to become a manager. You probably make a little bit more money. So the question is not so much about the compensation or the finance. It's more about, what do you want to do? Do you want to be an individual contributor, a professional, a specialist? Well, keep in mind, those countries, there's a lot of value in recognizing the craft or the trade that you belong to versus management. You know, at the same time, and we have this in some of our sites, if you're in an organized workforce in a union, you could have plant operators or people that are on the hourly scale. They make more than a manager. Sure. So if you're going to grow your career and you are in a technical field, why want to manage people? So it's really important for companies to understand, what is the member's desire or the employee's desire to get onto a leadership path? And what are the sacrifices they need to make? Because you're in the union, you're making X dollars an hour, you got overtime, and you've got a pension plan. Now, if I go to the manager, if I want to take you to a manager role, do I need to add everything up and then give an increase? Or this is the manager pay scale. This is where you're going to start. It's going to be lower than what you currently make, but this is how you're going to grow in your career as a manager. And the compensation will come with it. What is your interest? So at Peckham Industries, we try to have those conversations and identify leaders that have the will to be a manager. And this is not about, I can make the same amount of money without overtime. That's not what we're trying to accomplish. And we clearly do not want to give that message to our employees that aspire to be managers, right? It's about a very different job. It's about getting the results through other people. It's not about you working overtime to deliver the result for yourself. They're two very different things. The manager role presents very different opportunities. And are you committed? And are those opportunities part of your passion? That's what we're trying to understand. And if yes, we are going to invest in the skills to help you grow. So it's very important for companies, I believe, that want to engage the post-millennial talent, Gen Z. How do you discern between your hourly workforce, your early career professionals, and who are those people that you want to put into your leadership funnel and invest and grow so that they become the managers and the executive team down the road?
So I have to ask the question, because we've been focused on building high performance teams and leaders. We've talked about adaptability for culture and from the Gen Z, and looking for a lot of influence on culture here, the willingness to actually want to be a leader. What I want to know now is, look around and turn 180 degrees. And you, as a CHRO, some of the top challenges that you have in your position, being able to be adaptable and looking for cultural differences, age differences, desirability to progress differences in your career, having that knowledge and making that a priority. How does that help solve some of the challenges for you as a CHRO?
It's a great question. Reflecting on the past experiences and understanding the needs of talent better. Right? So I think that's the value of engagement service, or not say the value of engagement. I think the value is really paying attention and dissecting your engagement survey results. A lot of companies do engagement surveys, but to what extent do they really dissect? It's different between, do I check the pulse? Or is it an X-ray? Or do I want to do an MRI on my engagement survey? There's a lot of information there. One of the things that we did is we decided to cater to the Gen Z, the newer workforce, and how we're going to work in the future, especially with all AI conversations. How are we becoming more and more digital in our HR offerings? So as an HR function, are our tools digital? Are we using the ERP platform the company has? Are we providing a one-stop shop access? Can you do things on your mobile phone while you're in the field? Because if you have a field workforce, they don't really have a computer in front of them. So how are you generating things through apps? So there's a technology element that's really going to help you if you can leverage that. I think the other piece is mentoring. I've been here 3 years. We put a lot of effort in building our HR infrastructure. We just completed the first year of our mentoring program and really centered around our values framework and how we show up in our jobs, reflecting the values. So that's the role of the mentor mentee, to discuss that and to identify opportunities where you can do a better job. Because culture is a differentiator for us from our growth strategy standpoint. But what we're doing, going to round two, given the demographics of workforce, is to have some of the executive team, what really boomers, mentor Gen Z high profiles. So who are the up-and-coming, they're ready to be a manager, but they're an individual contributor, they are a post-millennial, they are Gen Z. Let's provide them a mentoring opportunity so that we can better understand them. We have more direct communication with them, make it comfortable for them to engage with us, and then look at, okay, what does this mean if we were to cater our needs and to be more efficient and effective with a Gen Z population. So those are kinds of things that we are trying. How do we make sure that we are very diverse in our mentoring approach, our engagement, and obviously from a team standpoint, and the tools allow two-way communication.
I know that we're running out of time here, and I wish we had another couple of hours because this is absolutely fascinating. But I want to ask one last question, and that is, based on everything that we've talked about so far, what's the one single takeaway that you want others, your peers, to take away from this podcast?
I think the theme of the conversation and what I found as the underrated aspect of leadership is adaptability. I'll start with reflecting on yourself. And then you can obviously look at the organization as a whole, or the business unit or the division or the country you're in, the business that you support is. If there was a leadership index between 1 to 10, where would you place yourself? Where would you place your business unit, your division, your organization? And that will give you some insights as to, if I put myself at a 5 or a 6, what would I do to become a 7? From a 7, what would I do to become an 8? Because guess what's not changing? We live in a world of constant change. You got to be adaptable in order to keep up with the growth and be competitive.
I think it's one of the most key things that you say. You chock full of great insights. But to be competitive, you have to have those teams that are at their highest performance. You have to retain those teams. And so therefore, you have to understand in a global basis how these teams are communicating, how they're functioning, or you are ultimately over time not going to be as competitive. So I think that's one of the best insights ever. And I know that people are going to have more questions than that. I know they are. Would it be appropriate if we gave out a link to your LinkedIn profile that people could reach out if they did have additional questions for you?
More than happy to have the discussion and conversation. Absolutely.
Fantastic. Thank you for the world of the global world of insights and ways that we think differently on that scale of 1 to 10. You gave it 11 or a 12, the importance of adaptability in all these ways that we've been talking about today. Thank you for all those insights.
It's a pleasure, Steve. Thank you so much for having me.